recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Author Salman Rushdie is known for his lyrical writing, magical realism, and complex plot lines. His latest novel combines historical and imaginary characters in a Baroque fairy tale that takes readers from 16th century India to Machiavelli's Florence. The book is titled The Enchantress of Florence, and Salman Rushdie joins me in the studio. I do welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Congratulations to you. Shall I call you Sir Rushdie?
No, please don't. I mean, I my old democratic instincts rebel against that.
Now, tell me how you learned of that. Tell me the story of how that came about.
The knighthood?
Yes.
Oh, well, you know, it was a year ago or so. I just had my publishers had a call from, I guess, one of them, as I afterwards discovered, one of the members of the committee that advises the government on these things. And I was just asked to make a phone call back to this gentleman who had something important to tell me. And I had no idea what it was about. So I called back and was, you know, was told this, that they were offering me this thing and would I accept? And I must say, it was a complete surprise. I mean, there are things in your life that you think, if you're lucky, you might come your way, you know.
And that was never in your mind.
It was just never on the radar at all. So it just came completely out of left field, and I was thrilled. And, you know, it's interesting in England. If you look at figures in the arts, it seems like a lot of pop stars get knighted, you know, Sir Mick, Sir Elton, Sir Paul, you know. Certain number of actors and playwrights, you know, like Ian McKellen or Dame Judi Dench or Tom Stoppard or so on. Relatively few writers of prose fiction. I mean, actually, amongst living people, but just about the only people I can think of right now. I mean, I don't have the full list, but V.S. Naipaul had a knighthood.
Yes.
And Antonia Byatt, A.S. Byatt, had the female equivalent. She's made a dame. But I think that's it.
How interesting.
And now me.
And what was the ceremony like? Describe it for us.
Oh, it's very, you know, it's the English are very good at ceremony, you know. So you go to Buckingham Palace and you're allowed to take three guests. I took my two sons and my sister and you go into this. There's this very grand ornamental staircase with soldiers at attention, with, you know, dress uniforms and swords at attention and so on. All very beautiful. And actually, I had never really seen the inside of Buckingham Palace before, and it was spectacularly lovely, full of great oil paintings and so on. And then I got taken, along with the other people receiving similar honours, into a rehearsal room, basically, a very beautiful rehearsal room where we were taught what we were supposed to do. You know, you have to walk forward and turn to face the Queen and nod and walk up to her, and there's a kneeling stool. Where you have to, I mean, it's quite a high stool, so you only just have to bend the knee, really, and there's conveniently a handrail to hold on to stop you falling over. and then she taps you on the shoulders with this sword. And then you stand up and she puts, there's a ribbon, which she puts around your neck. And then she talks to you for, you know, like a minute. And then you shake hands. She offers you a hand. You shake hands. You walk backwards several steps, and then you turn to your right and exit. You know. So,
what did she say to you?
Well, really, she just asked me what I was working on. You know, she asked me what was I doing now, and
had she read any of your books? She say that?
Like, she didn't say
she
that.
She didn't
but, I mean,
say
and,
that.
And one of the things about this kind of exchange is that you can't really ask a question.
Yes.
You know? You just speak when you're spoken to and answer the question that you're asked.
Right.
But she was just asked what I was working on and doing next, and so I talked to her a little bit about that. And it was just a couple of sentences.
All right. Now, tell me about the storm of protests set off in Pakistan.
You know, actually, you have to understand that it wasn't really that much. I mean, that's there was an attempt to make a fuss. You know, sometimes I wish when the media, when television cameras covered a protest, I wish that they'd show the long shot. You know, and you look at the long shot, then it's 10 idiots in a parking lot. You know, when you show the close-up, it looks like a mob, you know. The truth is that almost nobody went. There were one or two nasty remarks. They were very largely rhetorical, and the proof is that it just very rapidly fizzled away. It showed that nobody was really that interested. So, and I mean, since then, it's been completely quiet, and actually now that the ceremony just took place, that, you know, elicited nothing. So, I mean, it was just a storm in a teacup.
You must have been relieved to realize that the press was exaggerating what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I've often felt that sometimes people are so anxious to have a kind of shocking headline that they do magnify the story, you know. And in this case, I think really essentially nothing happened. I mean, not because, well, for no reason other than that people weren't that interested.
Well, I'm glad for your sake that you can feel that way, continue writing. You've said in previous interviews that you want to be known as a writer and not as a martyr.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way the worst consequence of the attack against the Satanic Verses is that it made people, I'm talking about people who have not read my work, you know, which is obviously most people. And I think for them, it made them think of me as, if you like, as non-fictional, you know, as part of a political event, or and later as some kind of political commentator or expert on you know, Islamic subjects and things like that. And I just felt that has nothing to do with why I became a writer. You know, I mean, the reason I became a writer was not to be a political entity. You know, it was to find stories to tell and tell them.
This is a very complicated story. Tell us how it began in your own mind.
Well, it started out really with, actually quite simply with my thinking that we live in a time when everybody's thinking about kind of the engagement between Eastern and Western culture. And in many ways, that's an enriching encounter. And in some ways, for many people, it's disturbing and even alarming, you know, so it has both those aspects. And I thought the interesting thing about this period, the late 15th and the mid to the mid 16th century, is that really in many ways this is the period at which the encounter certainly between India and the West began. You know, the first Western travelers arrived in India only in the late 15th century. You know, Vasco da Gama came and started the spice trade. The Portuguese made their little colony in Goa at the early 16th century. But even by the time of the book, which is the reign of the great Emperor Akbar, who was more or less an exact contemporary of Elizabeth I of England, I mean, they ruled their countries for the whole of the second half of the 16th century. Even at that time, the amount of contact between East and West was absolutely minimal. They hardly knew about each other. And so I thought, how interesting to look at these. And yet, these were both cultures going through a golden age. You know, the European Renaissance, one of the great moments in the history of Europe. And the reign of the Emperor Akbar in India was a similar kind of renaissance in music and painting and architecture and poetry and so on. You know, so in both worlds, these were really extraordinary moments. You know, and yet they barely knew about each other. And I thought if I could come up with a story that connects them, how interesting that would be. And so I ended up finding this, I mean, making up this love story.
There is a passage in your book that really talks about exactly that, how far apart we are and yet how we are one. Would you read that for us?
Yes, this is actually, a passage in which the Emperor Akbar is meditating about his own position in life. And really, it's true that one of my discoveries in writing this book was when I thought I was writing about these two disconnected, very different worlds, I kept finding mirrorings and similarities and echoes, you know. So, if you like, it was also the author's discovery that these worlds were more alike than unlike. Right? So this is the Emperor Akbar thinking. Again, at once, he was mired in contradictions. He did not wish to be divine, but he believed in the justice of his power, his absolute power. And given that belief, this strange idea of the goodness of disobedience that had somehow slipped into his head was nothing less than seditious. He had power over men's lives by right of conquest. That was the inevitable conclusion to which any realistic prince must come, that might was right, and all the rest, this endless meditation on virtue, for example, was decoration. The victor was the man of virtue. That was all that needed to be said. Difference existed. There would be executions and suicides, but discord could be quelled, and it was his fist that could quell it. But what, then, of the voice within that whispered every morning about harmony? Not the foolish all-men-are-one nostrums of the mystics, but this stranger idea, that discord, difference, disobedience, disagreement, irreverence, iconoclasm, impudence, even insolence, might be the wellsprings of the good. These thoughts were not fit for a king. He thought of the faraway dukes in the foreigner's tale. They did not claim a divine right to their lands either, but only the right of the victor. Their philosophers, too, portrayed the human being standing at the center of his time, his city, his life, his church. But foolishly, they ascribed man's humanity to God. They required divine sanction to support their case in the matter, the higher matter of man, even though they dispensed with the need for such a sanction in the lower matter of power. How confused they were, and how little they were, too, ruling a mere city in Tuscany and a Roman bishopric to go with it, and how much they thought of themselves. He was the ruler of the frontierless universe, and he saw more clearly than they. No, he corrected himself, he did not, and was indulging in mere bigotry if he asserted it. Mogor had been right. The curse of the human race is not that we are so different from one another, but that we are so alike.
Salman Rushdie, reading from his brand new novel. It's titled The Enchantress of Florence. You'll hear more about her when we return after a short break. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up at 11.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, finding insight in unexpected places. First, a former federal prosecutor finds the truth about our criminal justice system in, of all places, hip-hop lyrics. Then, our series celebrating the culinary diversity of our region continues with a peek inside the modern Indian kitchen, going way beyond curry. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Hi, this is Bill Redlin. At this time of year, people of many faiths and those who practice no religion celebrate the good things in our lives and share the celebration with family and friends. That's what I'm doing, and I hope that you are able to relax, enjoy, and celebrate too.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Welcome back. Salman Rushdie is with me. We're talking about his brand new novel. It's titled The Enchantress of Florence. And we do invite your calls, 800-433-8850, as well as your email to drshow@wamu.org. You ended that reading with the sentence, "The curse of the human race is not that we are so different from one another, but that we are so alike." Pick up on that thought.
Well, see, one of the things that I really was a revelation to me as I studied the world of this past, you know, the pre-modern world, as it's called, is, first of all, its extraordinary echoes with our world. I mean, that's to say, if we believe ourselves to be caught up in brutal wars and, you know, surrounded by cynicism and small-mindedness writ large, if you like, well, that exactly the same thing was happening then. contrarywise, if we believe, if we can see around ourselves the creation of great art and beauty and so on, of course, that was true then too. So both at the kind of best and worst of the human race, it's very easy to see ourselves projected into the past because, you know, we're the same species. We've always been doing this stuff. And then inside the world of the book, I discovered that, you know, in this period in the Renaissance, you have the birth, really, of humanistic philosophy. I mean, the birth of the idea of the sovereign individual self, the idea that we are the masters of our destinies, and so on. You know, that is the gift of the Renaissance to the modern world, the idea of our self-importance, if you like. And yet, at the same time, halfway around the world, with no conferring, you know, in the thoughts of the Emperor Akbar and his court, there are very similar doubts about the absolute rightness of religion and the relative role of the human individual in his society and so on. So the same things are going on. And even at a much, if you like, more degraded level of social and sexual behavior, these are both worlds in which people lock up their daughters, you know, so and in which arranged marriages are the norm and so on, East and West, you know. And so, of course, the consequence of this is that young men needing entertainment turn to women of somewhat easier virtue. And so the phenomenon of the courtesan is very large in both East and West in exactly the same way. And the salons of the courtesans were not just simple brothels. They were also kind of exclusive clubs where the best wits, the most talented musicians, the greatest courtiers would all, you know, go for the evening. And it's extraordinary to find that mirroring, you know, in two different worlds.
Fascinating to me that you could have created a novel that bridged these two worlds in a far more straightforward way. But you have chosen to write stories within stories, fairy tales within fairy tales.
But at the heart of it, there's a love story. I mean, at the heart of it, there's the thing that really makes the bridge, you know, is the story of this princess, the title character, this princess who may or may not possess magical powers, who is first captured as a spoil of war, a Mughal princess who gets captured by a rival warlord and then liberated by the king of Persia, who she decides she fancies, and so she stays with him for a while until he's defeated in another battle. And eventually she falls in love with this Italian soldier of fortune called Argalia, who is at that moment working as a mercenary for the Ottoman Sultan, the Turkish Sultan. And he brings her back to Florence, where she creates a great flurry and kerfuffle. and so at the heart of it is that. And I had some evidence in history, or some sort of source material in the record. There's the great poem Orlando Furioso, which is the great narrative poem of the Renaissance written by Ariosto. It's set much earlier. It's set in hundreds of years earlier, in the time of Charlemagne and knights in shining armor and so on. But it's written at exactly this moment, and it's about an Indian princess coming to Europe and creating havoc. You know, so that gave
and it, the havoc is because of her great beauty.
Her great beauty and the suspicion of witchcraft. The two things put together, it's a very strange thing that happens in the Renaissance. That partly because the mind of the Renaissance looked back to antiquity, looked back to the Greeks and Romans, and found there such figures as Circe, you know, the sorceress slash beauty, you know. They began to make a curious linkage between the sexual desirability of women and occult power. You know, that women could be both enchantresses in the sense of being desirable, but also literally casters of spells, you know. And they return to this theme in painting and poetry and so on over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that this is a knife edge for a woman to walk. You know, on the one hand...
You bet.
You know, I mean, on the one hand, you can be extra adored, if you like. You know, people believe you to be capable of miracles and so on, and they fall at your feet and et cetera, and write love
which
poetry.
Which is what happens to her.
But the other thing can happen too, which is if there's a change in the wind, you know, the mood of the public changes, the same people who were adoring you one day, that same mob can come to, you know, lynch you the next day.
She actually travels with a woman who looks very much like her. She's not quite as beautiful.
And she is a slave girl, yes.
And is a slave girl, but the two sort of interchange.
Yes, I also think I'm about a year away from having finished the book. I mean, I myself am beginning to think that that's the real love story in the novel. You know, that's to say that these two women who have traveled the world together, you know, and for each other, they are the only piece of the world they come from that each they still have. You know, the only little trace of home that either of them has is the other one. You know, so the person who knows the world they came from, who knows the language that they spoke, and, you know, who knows them from the beginning. You know, they are the only ones who know that about each other. And so I think in many ways they become each other's real point of reference, you know, and most intimate relationship. And men come and go, you know, but their love for each other is the thing that's constant.
Now, I want to go back to the ceremony of your knighthood when you said that your two sons and your sister were with you. Your third marriage has failed.
Yeah.
That must have been quite a blow to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course it is. It was a long relationship in the sense that it was, you know, 8.5 years or something, and it's always awful when such a thing comes to an end, especially when you don't want it to. But I have to say that the thing that got me through last year was writing this book. I mean, I think it's a wonderful gift that one has as an imaginative artist is that you can sink into your imaginative world and that becomes the world, you know, while you're doing it. And it certainly helped me through.
You had a marriage while you were under the fatwa, and that marriage came apart.
Yeah. Yes, I'm not good at it. What can I tell you?
Do you think that's it?
No, I mean, I don't know if that's it. I mean, they've all been very long relationships, you know. I mean, one of them was... My first marriage was almost 14 years, and the marriage to the mother of my younger son was 10 years, and this one was 8.5. So it's not like I'm, you know, spending 6 months with people. I don't know. I just think people grow up and change and grow apart, and who knows why marriages fail. I mean, I'm not proud of it. You know, I'm kind of embarrassed about it.
But when you say I'm not good at it, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, just in terms of objective reality. I mean, there they all are, you know, too many divorces.
Matter how well you can communicate with the world on paper, that you have difficulty communicating with the person closest to you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just that... you know, things run out of steam. I mean, I think it's more to do with that. I mean, you can be, I mean, I think it may be that our idea of romantic love, that it's eternal and undying and so on, is just mistaken. You know, I mean, there's actually a moment in the novel where one of the characters, you know, thinks about his beloved that yes, she does love him, but only until she doesn't. You know, and that idea that these emotions are finite, you know, that they don't necessarily last forever, is, I think, you know, as plausible as the idea that they do endure forever, you know. And if you're lucky, something else endures, which is, you know, companionship and intimacy and things that go on after the end of romantic love. That it's, you know, it's difficult, men and women, it's difficult business.
Did those ideas come into The Enchantress of Florence?
Yeah, I suppose they must have. I mean, you know, if you have a lifetime of, you know, romantic and marital and sexual experience, of course, it all informs what you write.
Salman Rushdie, his new novel is titled The Enchantress of Florence. We will open the phones, take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to Jenison, Michigan. Good morning, Andre. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, in your wildest dreams, do you expect to live long enough to see the emergence of a scientifically provable theory of Earth and Moon origin?
I have no idea what that means, really.
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Andre.
Science.
science. Well, what does that have to do specifically with Salman Rushdie's novel?
If there is a scientifically provable theory of Earth and Moon origin, wouldn't that invalidate the Book of Genesis and cause the three world major Abrahamic religions to fall?
Well, I think actually the truth is that that it's not just the origin of the Earth and the Moon that you're talking about, I suspect, but that of the universe, which is a little larger than the Earth and the Moon. And I think, in my view, is that we already have very substantial amounts of scientific information which show us that how those things happened. And, I mean, the Book of Genesis is clearly, you know, if you're going to take it literally, is not how it happened, and nor is the account given by any other major world religion. And in spite of this information, these religions, you know, persist. And so I don't think that's going to be the thing that knocks them into touch, you know. But yes, let's not talk about contemporary science.
Do you think that there is any one thing that you can imagine that would prove that there is a God?
Well, he would have to show up, wouldn't he?
He would have to show up.
Yeah, exactly. And in the absence of that, I know, you know, we will all continue to hold our rival opinions on the subject.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Mel in Dallas, Texas, who says, we are repeatedly told that the vast majority of Muslims are peaceful moderates and that the radicals who advocate murderous jihad are atypical. Can the moderates retake their religion, or are the radicals invulnerably pressured from within? Are we destined to an existential war between Islam and the West?
You know, I don't know is the answer to that question, because it's prophesying the future is a mug's game, you know, and we can all, I mean, have our views about it, but history has a way of showing us all to be wrong. I myself think that there is great momentum at the moment behind the radicals, you know, in many different countries. But I think that's, if you like, that's political momentum rather than public support. It's very hard to quantify this because most of these countries don't have democratic elections and they don't have a way for the people to actually make their true feelings known. They're either dictatorships or religious dictatorships or in some way, you know, a-democratic. If you look at the recent Pakistani election, which was one of the few cases where a large Muslim country was actually allowed to vote, they did not vote for the Muslim parties at all. I mean, if you like, the two major parties which in coalition now run Pakistan are both secularist parties and both kind of modern democratic parties. Mm-hmm. The radicals got less than 1% of the vote. You know, so that's what happened in the one recent case where a Muslim country was actually allowed to vote. I mean, the problem of our age is that 1%, that very small minority, can have a disproportionately large effect. You know, in the case of Pakistan, it could assassinate the leader of the opposition, Benazir Bhutto. But as I say, in terms of what the country actually wanted when it was allowed to express its view, 99 out of 100 people voted against them.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from a professor of world religion at a university in Florida who asks, do you still consider yourself a Muslim? How should those of us who consider ourselves liberals engage with the problem of radical Islam?
Well, no, I don't consider myself a Muslim. I come from a Muslim family, but actually, and some members of my family were very devout and others not. My own parents fell into the latter category. And so, I mean, I was brought up in a very secularized kind of modern atmosphere, really, and the kind of, if you were to make a kind of Christian comparison, the kind of family which goes to church on Christmas Day, you know, but the rest of the year doesn't really pay much attention to religious matters. That was how I was brought up. And so I've never really been a religious person. How to confront radical Islam? I mean, I think it's, I mean, how long have you got? It's a huge subject. But I think we've been making some mistakes. I mean, I think the great problem about the intervention in Iraq is that that was a place in which radical Islam did not have a foothold, and now does. So, if you like, there's a cautionary tale about how not to go about it. In the end, it's going to have to be overthrown from inside the Muslim world. I mean, that's the real fact. If you look at how the IRA was brought to the peace table, it basically happened because its own constituency, that's to say Northern Ireland Catholics, decided that they didn't wish to be defined by the IRA and rejected the path of violence. You know, that's what's going to have to happen inside the Muslim world. Now, all we can do is try and encourage that.
Do you see prospects for that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there are. I mean, if you talk to a younger generation of people across the Muslim world, that's what they all want.
Salman Rushdie, his new novel, The Enchantress of Florence. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up next, it's a Prairie Home Companion. Later this afternoon on Bob Edwards Weekend.
Last year on Long Island, a gang of teenagers murdered Marcelo Lucero because he was a Latino.
I don't know how many lives of brown-skinned people it will take for the mainstream politicians to finally stand up and say enough is enough.
Our original documentary, Hating Marcelo, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI.
And that's Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
This is Kojo Nambi. If we can make the audience care by bringing whatever topic we're discussing into their lives and into their children's lives and into their living rooms, we would like to think that we've succeeded.
The Kojo Nambi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Weekdays at noon on WAMU 88.5.
If you've been a contributing member of WAMU 88.5 for years, consider making a bequest. It could be a better way of meeting your charitable giving needs, and it could also provide WAMU 88.5 with much-needed support for years to come. For more information about bequests, contact your financial advisor or visit WAMU.org and click on support.
I'm Nakia Andrews.
I'm Doreen Hodge.
And I'm Whitney Boggs from the underwriting team at WAMU 88.5.
Wishing you a happy holiday season.
With a special thank you to our corporate sponsors.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Welcome back to the wonderful new novel by Salman Rushdie, titled The Enchantress of Florence. Here's an email from Charles in Birmingham, Alabama, who says, as I read The Enchantress of Florence, I found myself reminded in many ways of novels by Umberto Eco and wondered if Enchantress represents Sir Rushdie's gauntless toss at the Italian author. I can almost imagine a conversation between Echo and Rushdie, where Echo might say, well, you can write lovely novels with characters from India, but you won't be able to write a novel set in Renaissance Italy. Does Enchantress represent Sir Rushdie's response to the Echo camp?
Well, I mean, I'd love it if that story were true. I know Umberto Eco quite well, and we were, in fact, quite recently on stage together in New York City during the Penn Festival in the spring. So, you know, we've done a number of things, but no, he's never challenged me exactly. I do think he's very funny about other people's books. He was actually asked about this book by the New York Times when it came out, and he said, you know, if people's books are like mine, I hate them. And then he said, if they're not like mine, I also hate them.
I hate them. How wonderful. The woman at the center of this story, talk about her.
Yes, well, her name is Karakoz, which means black eyes, Lady Black Eyes. And one of the reasons for calling her that is that if you read the Eastern poetry of this period, the idea of a woman with black eyes is very often the kind of beloved of love poetry. You know, people, girls are praised for the beauty of their black eyes. So that's why I selected that as her name. It's actually her nickname, but it's the name that everyone uses. And she is she's faced with a remarkable series of choices which then become her character. Let's say she is first handed over as a spoil of war to a rival warlord and becomes his captive for a period of time. And then when he is defeated, she has the opportunity of going home. You know, she's offered the chance of going back where she came from. But at that moment, if you like, her adventurous spirit asserts itself, and she decides that she kind of rather desires the king of Persia who's liberated her, that she'd rather stay with him. And so, you know, it's if you like, that the tragedy of her life or the sadness of her life is that her adventurous spirit leads her further and further away from home and essentially burns her bridges behind her so she can't go home again. You know, so it's both about the journey as a desirable thing, you know, as an excitement, an adventure, but also the way in which journeys can separate us from our past. You know, the book becomes about, or her story becomes about both those things.
Let's open the phones, going now to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Mr. Rushdie.
Hello.
Hello. It's a thrill to speak with you. I really enjoy your work very much.
Thank you.
I just wanted you to know that one of your books is actually indirectly responsible for me and my wife being married. And
which
you
one?
You were talking about your Fury, actually, is the book. And you were talking about the romantic influence in this new book, and I've noticed it in a lot of your books. But anyway, there's a singer that we enjoy very much, and he references a lot of literary works in his songs, and one of his songs contained a line from your book, Fury.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm flattered to hear it. I had a woman come up to me at a book signing the other day and told me something similar about my novel, The Ground Beneath Her Feet. She said that when she got engaged to be married, she made her fiancé read that novel.
Oh, my.
As a kind of test. And I said, I asked her, I said, would it have been a deal breaker if he hadn't liked it? And she said, no question. But they are married, so obviously he passed the test.
Keith, how long have you been married?
We're going on 3 years.
Good for you. Oh, thanks for calling. Let's go now to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sir Salman, let me say it's a great honor to speak with you. I'm a great admirer of your work.
Thank you.
A recent issue of The Futurist magazine concerned itself with the evolution of fiction and the place that fiction will hold in the 21st century.
Uh-huh.
The film director, Ridley Scott, said that film was the theater of the 20th century and will be the literature of the 21st. And I was wondering, as a key and central figure to modern world fiction, where do you see popular fiction or fiction in general going in this new and challenging century?
Well, you know, I'm a great admirer of film as well, so I don't see this as a kind of either-or question. I mean, Ridley Scott, he's a friend of mine, and I enormously admire his work. And I do think that film at its best is fully the equal of a great novel. Blade Runner, for example, I think is a film that would stand up against most contemporary novels. I do think that the great gift that literature has is its intimacy. You know, it takes place inside the reader's mind. A movie takes place on a screen and you watch it, but a novel is played out inside your own imagination and interacts with that imagination. And I think the reason for the durability of the form is that, you know, private conversation between the imagination of the writer and the imagination of the reader. And people have always found that very attractive, and I suspect always will. And I think the other great gift that literature can give us, and speaking as a reader, is it takes you into worlds which are not your world.
Exactly.
and makes you feel that they are. You know, I mean, I read the literature of the United States before I'd ever come to America.
Mm.
And when I came here, I knew something about the country I'd come to because of having read, you know, everything from Faulkner and Steinbeck to more contemporary writers. So, you know, whether it's taking us into the past or into a foreign country, we can gain the world through literature, and I think it's a unique gift of the form.
Thanks for calling, Paul. And
thanks.
Now to Winston, Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Arjun. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Sir Rushdie.
Thank you.
I have a question about how popular you think your novel will be, meaning is there anything in the novel that you think would elicit a reaction from either the Asian or the European community that would make them say, that's awesome, or would it have a negative reaction?
Seems to be doing very well, thank you. I mean, I'm just in the middle of book tour, and I just came back from the West Coast, and it's at this moment number one in the L.A. Times and number one in the San Francisco Chronicle, so I suspect it's doing something right.
Thanks for calling. And here's an email from Ben in Columbia Heights here in Washington. Please tell us about the specific histories and sources you used to do research on your novel and its settings in Europe and India.
Well, you'll find at the back of the book a lot of books referenced that were helpful to me, and I just wanted to acknowledge that this book stands on the shoulders of those books, and also to say that, you know, if you enjoy the journey you've been on through my book and want to continue that journey, there's a lot of books that you could read that would, you know, would deepen your enjoyment and knowledge of the past.
This is really quite an extensive bibliography.
No, I did my homework.
Yes, you really, really did. And I think readers are going to enjoy going through those.
The thing that's interesting, there are for instance, The Reign of the Emperor Akbar, there are some very long, very detailed contemporary histories. So they were written in Persian, but they exist in very good translations, and so one can use those. And the Renaissance, of course, there's a gigantic amount of material. But what you mostly need as a writer, you know, is not so much the political history. It's easy to find that stuff out. But what you need is ordinary life. You know, when people went shopping, what did they buy? When people got cross with each other, what terms of abuse did they use? You know, it's that kind of stuff. The small change of the past is what brings it to life.
And to Newbury, Ohio. Hi there, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks. And
are you there, Bill? Oh, dear. He was on his cell phone. I think it faded out. Let's try Lucy in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes, hello.
Hi there. Go right ahead.
Hi, Mr. Rushdie. I just finished reading your novel, The Moor's Last Sigh, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
I had a question about the sort of speech that the characters, the female characters, specifically Aurora and her mother and the family, they said speakify and, you know,
yes.
OFY. I was just wondering what, if that was sort of like a dialect twist.
No.
Or
no, it's just it's a family tic. I mean, I have heard people in India speak in all kinds, with all kinds of strange variations of the English language. And that was just a kind of comic tick I made up for that particular family to use. But I'm very glad you liked the novel.
You know, you talked earlier about the central character of the book, her black eyes, her magical powers, and yet how that cuts a very thin knife that women have been saddled with.
Yes.
How do you see that? Or do you see that as relevant to Hillary Clinton and her candidacy?
Might be, you know, I mean, it might be. I think it is harder for women, you know, there's no question. I mean, I come from a very female family, you know. I mean, that's it. I had three sisters, no brothers. And in my larger extended family, you know, aunts, female cousins, and so on, far outnumbered male relatives. So I was always brought up amongst very strong, brilliant, argumentative, opinionated, determined women, and many of them rose to be very prominent in different fields. But there's no question that it's tougher for them. It was much tougher for them. I mean, I had a sister who was a lawyer. She found it very difficult, hard going to be a lawyer in Pakistan. Difficult, you know. Clients wouldn't pay you. Judges would sometimes sneer at you just because you were a woman. So you know, there is it is harder. You have to be twice as good. And it,
even that, in this country, even now,
I fear so. Yes, I fear so.
That in all the transition, in all the growth, in all the change that has come about, not only in this country but in other parts of the world as well, it's still an uphill battle.
But I do think that, I mean, Hillary may or may not have, I mean, she's not got the candidacy, but I do believe she's broken the glass ceiling. I mean, I do think that actually she's now made it absolutely evident that it's perfectly plausible that a woman should run for president and therefore be president. You know, I think she's made that.
Why should it have been so difficult in this country, considering the precedents that have already been there?
And I just think, actually, you know, I have a lot of admiration for Hillary Clinton, and had she won the nomination, it would have been very easy to get behind that. I just think she came up against a candidate who had this extra gear. You know, I think that Obama just has an inspiring quality that is very rare, and she just, you know, it was unlucky for her.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Jacques in Miami, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Mr. Rushdie.
Hello.
I have two little commentaries. Mr. Rushdie spoke about how a man sometimes, a woman is adored by a man. After adoring him, he will hate her. There is a little story in the Bible. Two children of King David, they were half sisters. Their name is Amnon and Tamar. That brother and sister, he adored that half sister. When after sleeping with her, he obliged her to go outside naked and to humiliate her in front of the court of everybody, because all that extreme love he had for her turned out to be hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because as Mr. Rushdie said, she is seducing, that she seduced him, and the result, and she is also an usurper.
Okay. Yeah.
The second commentary, a lady spoke about moderate Islam and extremist Muslims. There is no question as moderate or extremist. The problem is with the Quran, the book of the Quran. In the Quran, it's written black on white, kill the infidels. It's a law by Prophet Muhammad. Kill them, wait for them with all your stratagem, and annihilate them, kill them. It's black on white, it's the Ten Commandments of the Quran. Kill them, and when you come here, that means the world after, we will wed you with beautiful girls. We will marry you with beautiful girls. If you want me to recite the
No, please don't.
No,
please don't.
Thank you.
Look, two points you make. The first is about the truthful point about the linkage sometimes between sexual desire and sexual hatred, which does happen. And certainly in what happens in this novel is that this girl who is adored is then rounded upon and has to run for her life. And that's part of what I wanted to write about. I mean, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm find myself in the odd position of being asked to defend the Quran. But it is true, I think, about any sacred text that it contradicts itself. You can find texts in the Quran which are bloodthirsty, as you say, and you can find other texts which say the opposite of that. I mean, there's a text in the Quran which says, I'll paraphrase it, but that if you find somebody who is an unbeliever, pass by on the other side. It doesn't talk about killing them. It talks about living side by side with people. So any sacred text is contradictory like that, and we don't have to look at the worst elements of it.
And here is the final email from Michelle in Gaithersburg, who says, I was in the audience at the book talk at Radio City Music Hall with John Irving, Stephen King, J.K. Rowling in August 2006, the night you asked your question about Professor Snape. What do you think of Professor Snape's outcome and the end of the entire Harry Potter series?
Well, I think I was absolutely right. I mean, the question, it wasn't actually I, it was my then 10-year-old son who was absolutely right. He just asked me to ask the question because he was shy. But his point is that the character of Snape is the determining character in the series. That's to say, you know, whether Snape is good or bad determines what happens at the end. And, well, he turns out to be good in a bad way, doesn't he, which is what we always suspected that he was.
Salman Rushdie, his new book, The Enchantress of Florence. He is, of course, the winner of the Booker Prize and was recently knighted by Queen Elizabeth. So thank you, Sir Rushdie, for being here.
Thank you. It's lovely to be back.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
The D.C. area has one of the highest AIDS rates in the country.
The Whitman Walker Clinic administers health care to thousands of people. It has specialty care for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community and those living with HIV/AIDS.
Its two centers in the district provide outpatient medical services, legal support, and confidential HIV tests.
Metro Teen AIDS.